Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Georgina was not prepared for the inequality found in the Defence Force in the mid-80s when she enrolled in the Armed Forces. However, she persevered, finished basic training, and was allocated to the Army Psychology Corps. After officer training, she was selected for an officer exchange in New Zealand and applied for the Australian Army Medical Corps as a health administrator. 30 years later, she ended up in the Director of Army Health. Through her long and varied career, Georgina was awarded a Conspicuous Service Cross in 2004, a Member of the Order of Australia in 2006, and awarded a bar to her Conspicuous Service Cross in 2016. She was named ACT Telstra Businesswoman of the Year in 2015 and awarded the ACT Public Service Award for Leadership in 2019. In this episode, we discuss Georgina's career, including her important pivot points, observations, and challenges she found during her career. Thanks, Georgina. All right, Georgina, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your insights with our listeners. I appreciate your time and thanks for sitting and having a yarn with me.
Thanks for the invitation, Sam.
It's a pleasure. Listen, so much to talk about, but I think the best place to start, I'm thinking, take us back to what got you into serving in the first place? What got you started on your journey that you're on today?
It is a journey of service. As you've pointed out, look, to be honest with you, I didn't have an enlightened moment. I was just desperate for a job. I had finished high school, was a little bit lost myself. And
what town were you in?
I was in Sydney, in Bankstown in Sydney. And I had failed to live up to some expectations. And so I was, working part-time in a supermarket, doing some sort of nannying and babysitting, and then I saw a recruiting van for the Defence Force and walked into the van, and 3 months later I was in the Army.
Wow. At what age was that?
I'd applied at 18 and I joined just after my 19th birthday.
Wow. Was it something that you knew what you're getting into? Did you have any idea, no concept of it?
No idea. I was stuck. Yep. I was stuck in Bankstown. Nothing wrong with Bankstown. I love Bankstown. It's where I grew up, but I was stuck.
Yeah.
And my parents had immigrated to Australia when I was 7 or 8 from Ireland to give myself and my 3 brothers and sister a better life. And they gave us a start, and that was where they got us to a point in time. And for me, it was about taking the next step, and it was the best step I have ever taken.
So tell me then, what age were you when you came to Australia, did you say?
7 or 8, yeah, so mid-70s.
Do you remember much of Ireland?
I do. I was back there last year visiting my family. I've been back a couple of times over the last 40-odd years and love it, still call it home.
Yeah.
Because home is where your family is, right? Yes. My parents have passed on, but still very close to my mother and father's extended family, and through social media and the internet we can remain pretty close, and has always been important for me to maintain those connections.
Yes.
Yeah, so I have very, very clear memories. In fact, I was in a taxi in Dublin last year on my way from one set of family members to another, and actually asked the taxi driver to do a detour to take me past where I grew up in the tenement flats in Dublin, 5 families sharing 1 bathroom, 1 bedroom. home. I came from nothing. My parents gave everything to raise the five of us, and feel very privileged indeed.
That would have been quite emotional seeing that house. Had it changed, obviously?
It had, because that area of Dublin is now being very gentrified.
Okay.
But there are, within a couple of kilometres, still the last of the flats, so to speak, where my grandmother and my aunties lived. They're just about to be demolished as part of further expansion to gentrification. And my parents and I and my brother lived there in my grandmother's flat for the last 6 months before we moved to Australia. So very, very familiar environment and setting.
Wow. Okay. So then you're on your journey. You've joined the force. How did it go with your expectations? If you didn't have any, obviously it would have been quite easy just enjoying the ride. But tell us a little bit about how you found it when you first joined up and some of the challenges.
Yeah, it was quite challenging in that I feel like I've been institutionalized sort of my whole life. Grew up a practicing Catholic, went to Catholic girls' school, and then straight into the army pretty much within 12 months of leaving school. And so I was very comfortable and used to structure.
Yes.
And certainly a degree of discipline instilled in a young girl growing up with nuns educating you. But I was not prepared for the inequality that I felt initially as a woman in the Defence Force. I joined the army in the mid-80s when women were being transitioned out of gender-specific training into, you know, all-core soldier training, so to speak. And I don't think the army or the Defence Force was ready for that level of integration in the 80s. And it was very apparent in terms of the manner in which women were treated and the exposure. Having said that, when I looked beyond that, I saw an institution that was good, that served the country, worked internationally, and could do further good. And that for me outweighed the challenges of being a woman in a very male-dominated environment in the mid-80s.
Yeah, the discrimination, that sort of thing would have been pretty rife.
It was really rife, you know, and I can remember. So today, just been listening to a fantastic presentation on research into LGBTIQ first responders and what we can do to, enhance health and well-being. I can remember in the late 80s, if you were homosexual, you were discharged from the army.
Is that right?
In fact, they'd send you to a psychiatrist to see if they could fix you. And I look to where we are now in a world with much greater equality that has been hard won. And, we've come a long way in 35, 40 years.
Yeah.
Still a long way to go, though.
No, I agree with that. So how did you find, you got posted, what was your first post with the military and where did you go and how did you find that?
Yeah, it was, so finished the basic training, survived that, and I was allocated to the Australian Army Psychology Corps as a psych examiner, so an assistant to a psychologist. So I was in Army Psychology for 2 years in Canberra and then in South Australia. And my boss, who went on to become the director of Army Psychology, encouraged me to throw my hat in the ring for officer training, which I did, and was subsequently selected. So started at Duntroon for my officer training and then was selected to go on to an exchange program as the first female officer cadet to go on exchange from Australia to New Zealand, and completed my officer training over there, returned back to Australia. And obviously, I couldn't come back to psychology corps as an officer because I didn't have a psychology degree. So I applied to go into the Australian Army Medical Corps as a general service officer. And so started my career then in the late 80s as a health administrator working in admin, logistics and operations. And 30 years later, ended up as the Director General of Army Health.
So back when you started as an assistant for psychology. How did you see the services back then, and was it something that was promoted? Was it something that was used even? I assume we've come a long way with this as well.
We have, and I was thinking about this yesterday actually after listening to a couple of presentations and then talking to a number of colleagues that are at the conference this week. And back then, mental health was really not a subject that was discussed. So the psychology core, first and foremost, were used as selection type processes. So they screened entry into the Defence Forces.
Okay.
So they conducted a lot of screening and had a big role to play in organisational psychology.
Okay.
With a very small, I want to say one person, two people research component. And what I was thinking about last night was psychology back then, from my very young, uneducated, but serving soldier experience, my observations was that you were sent to the psychologist if the organisation thought there was something wrong with you. And the psychologist would decide whether you could stay in the army or whether they okay. would transition you. There was nothing about wellness or recovery. It was, and of course, a number of my psychology colleagues will probably disagree with me, but to where psychology is now and where it sits organizationally, and it actually has such a powerful influence on everything from health and well-being through to human performance and research. So it has evolved extensively. And to be honest, as a young soldier, if I had my time over, I would say psychology now is seen as a force for good, where 35 years ago, if you were sent to the psychologist, it was probably the end of your career.
Yeah, it's amazing how far we've come.
Absolutely.
So then you were with the Australian Army Medical Corps. As what was the role on that team?
So I essentially, over the years, my roles varied from health administration and logistics right through to running hospitals and then deploying hospitals overseas on humanitarian aid disaster relief operations. And then it culminated in the most senior role in the Army Health Service, overseeing how Army provided healthcare to Army and how we delivered garrison healthcare across the Australian Defence Force.
Obviously you've earned your stripes through that role. Was it something you ever thought you were going to end up doing? I mean, and did you, when you started out, I don't even assume, was there someone even doing that when you first started?
No, I was the first non-doctor, non-clinician in a number of my postings throughout my career. I used to call myself the accidental brigadier, and that was because I came through a period of time where Army was losing a lot of its clinicians. They weren't staying in for a long-term career. And probably the turning point for me was in 2002. I was a newly promoted lieutenant colonel, and I undertook a posting in Sydney, and my soon-to-be boss, who was a full colonel doctor, resigned over the Christmas period. So when I arrived, I had no boss. And about a week into the role, the general that was in charge of the organisation I was working for sort of said, "Where's your boss?" And I said, "Sir, he's left." And he hadn't been briefed, clearly, by his staff. And a couple of days later, he called me in and said, "Well, we've got no one else, so we're going to give you a run." And he said, "How long have you been a lieutenant colonel for?" And I said, "Oh, 8 days." So I worked my butt off in that year, learned a lot, surrounded myself with really good clinicians, engaged with the subject matter experts. And what I discovered was, I think my secret superpower is I don't do much myself, but I'm very good of making the best use of everything that is available to me. And I work hard to collaborate and bring people together. So I was very fortunate that through a combination of full-time Army Health staff and our part-time Army Health Reserve specialists, I almost put together Team Whelan, and that team stayed with me for the remaining 15 years of my career at various points. And at no time did I ever misunderstand my role. I've always had a really, really, pardon the pun, but healthy respect for healthcare providers and clinicians. And, you know, as I said, my superpower is just organizing them and getting the best out of them. And I think as a consequence of that, there was more opportunities opened up for me. But ultimately, I hit the glass ceiling.
Well, what an opportunity just back on you. I mean, the timing of that and for you being almost the last one, well, the first and the only one there.
Yeah.
To get that opportunity, but then to seize that and have a really good crack at it. I just think, and the fact that you were mentioning the fact that you had, really you didn't need to be the smartest person in the room, but you needed to get the people in the room that could tell you the answers. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And we, in that 2002-2003 period, we introduced what was the first framework for mental health and well-being in the Land Army, and it was called the Land Command Health Continuum. And I still remember the PowerPoint presentation and the diagram that we put together that talked about everything from prevention through to recovery and transition. And it was, it was very simple but clear intent to address what were the gaps in our health system and to address the attrition that we were experiencing through a lack of coordination to healthcare delivery and mental health care delivery. And very proud, I was awarded a Conspicuous Service Cross in 2005 for that work. But I think that sort of whet my appetite for where we could go and how I could work to shape and influence and adjust the view on particularly mental health and the stigma attached to that in the Defence Forces at the time. And yeah, I then deployed a couple of years later to the Boxing Day tsunami as the commanding officer of the Australian Defence Hospital that was deployed. And humanitarian aid disaster relief had always been an area of interest of mine, and we were able to deliver, I think, really great outcomes for a devastated community. But when I came back to Australia, I saw firsthand the impact trauma would have had on our people. And my own lived experience, you know, following that deployment, I think just heightened my desire to continue on this pathway of trying to contribute to continuous improvement in our health services.
What year was that?
To 2005.
Okay, you came back from your deployment.
Yeah, came back from the deployment just before Anzac Day.
Yes.
And just, I was actually at the Anzac Day morning service where it sort of hit me what we had just done, the 3-month life-changing experience we had all had, and the fact that our journey was only just starting for ourselves. We deployed great work, treated, you know, tens of thousands of people, contributed to re-establishing, you know, a health system in Arche. But we came back with 154 people who had had probably the worst experience or exposure in their lifetime. And what did that mean for us? And what, how would that impact on us personally, with our families and professionally? And as I said, it sort of galvanized me to sort of keep going and contributing to how we could support our people better.
So did that experience for you personally drive, or you already had the drive, I guess, but the want to further develop that aspect of how things were done and how what services were available and at what point people were made aware of that?
Yeah, it did. So in 2008, 2009, I moved back to the job I had acted in 6 years earlier on promotion, and was given fantastic support by the commander of the Land Forces at the time to continue to evolve the program we had established in 2002 and expanded into the delivery of high intensity training for our soldiers prior to their deployment into the Middle East. And that training that we delivered seen to not only prepare them to respond, but it was having a direct impact on their resilience in a really positive way, and their teamwork and their sense of identity on deployments. And that culminated in the program becoming accepted as the program that everybody in the ADF would undertake prior to deployment into the Middle East area of operations.
And when you say training, are we talking about physical or both physical, mental?
Physical, mental. So the environment of the live training environment that we created allowed us to do a crawl, walk, run in preparation for how they would respond in the event they or their colleagues were injured. And we exposed them to the various mechanisms of injury, and we put them into environments where the simulation was as close as possible as to the environment they would be operating in. And not only did that increase their skill, they felt more confident as a consequence of undertaking that training. They felt better prepared. They felt like the organisation was investing in them. And then obviously we had a number of soldiers and other ADF members who were injured and killed, as we know, in the Middle East. But a number who were injured talked about the confidence they had in their colleagues responding to them and their injury in their time of need, and the difference that made to them in terms of their hope for recovery and a feeling of confidence in the organisation, which I think is quite significant, not only at the time, point of injury, but years later when you are recovering your physical injuries you've recovered from, but the trauma and the exposure. I like to think in some small way that training contributed to a better mental health outcome for individuals.
So they were given scenarios to prepare them and put in a position that was pretty similar to what they would be experiencing on deployment, so that they can see what situations arose, how they reacted physically and mentally, and then debriefed after it and given some tools and stuff.
Absolutely. And it was the way the program was run, it was not to fail them. So we partnered with two Australian organisations, so that one of the organisations we partnered with was CareFlight. And of course they have a policy of do no further harm and psychological safety in their training. So the program really had a mentoring factor to it, and we eased them into it. And I'm actually introducing that program now in my current role as the Commissioner of the Emergency Services Agency. And we just completed our first training activity in September last year, centred around obviously not the Middle East area of operations, but bushfire, a flood, a storm, and the all hazards environment.
What a great idea. I mean, so this was back in, what year was this that
so
you first
started,
ordered that?
Yeah, so we sort of formed the idea in 2008, 2009 and had the program fully running by 2012.
And so when you broke down the areas of opportunity for health and wellbeing and different times at which education, awareness, checking in, that sort of thing, was that done in the induction, the training, the preparation, during the service, during battle, during combat, post-service as well? Like, did you look at every aspect of this and take a holistic approach to seeing where the opportunities were?
I personally didn't, but I like to think I was within a system of systems and a continuum.
Yep.
And at the time I was doing or playing my part, ADF Health was looking at that full continuum of care and introducing concepts called Smart Soldier. And they were introducing the peer support program and the resilience, and they were embedding a number of those programs into the training life cycle of a member of the ADF. So it was starting at the beginning and then reinforced throughout their career. And, you know, that sort of reached its maturity probably around 2015 to 2017, when the ADF mental health strategy really became something that could be actually implemented. It wasn't just a glossy magazine on strategy. It really looked at practical ways in which we could, you know, reduce the prevalence of mental health. And of course, nothing is perfect. And that was around the same time that we started seeing a spike in suicides in members of the ADF. And little did we know then what we know now through the Royal Commission, the increase in likelihood of suicide post-service for veterans. But it was the point in time, sort of in sort of the 15, 16, 17 period of the last decade, where elements of a mental health continuum were really starting to come together and be connected, rather than what had been for quite some time a lot of really, you know, great people with really good ideas all doing their bit.
Yeah.
It was doing their bit together under the Joint Health Agency within the ADF.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Mm. 2017, you went to ACT Emergency Services Agency, the SES. What made you transition to that? How did the opportunity arise, and then what was the role?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, at some point being a non-doctor, I hit a glass ceiling. So there was really only one step up available career-wise, and it wasn't going to happen for me. I wasn't a doctor. And so I had been offered a non-health job, and I took up that opportunity hesitantly, but nevertheless soldiered on, so to speak. But I wasn't happy. I felt quite disconnected from the organisation, and I didn't feel the same sense of satisfaction in service. So I was really just starting to think about, okay, it's time to do something different. And a very distant colleague contacted me and said, there's a couple of interesting jobs that are being advertised at the moment in ACT government. You should have a look at them. And I thought, okay. And he said, really? And I said, yeah. I said, timing for your phone call has been great. I've just been thinking about what's next for me. So I took a look and saw the State Emergency Service Chief Officer's job. And to be honest with you, Sam, I was really worried I wasn't qualified. I hadn't had a job interview since the day I joined the Army.
Yeah.
And really was questioning whether I was competitive enough, but I threw my hat in the ring and nevertheless was offered the position. And so I took long service leave from the Army initially for a year and jumped in, and then resigned from the Army by mid-2018. Yeah.
You had over 30 years of service with the ADF. I mean, that's a big milestone in its own. So much experience, so much learning and growth for you as a person individually, but also professionally, I guess. So, I mean, there would have been an aspect that you would have been well-skilled. You've had a lot of experience to come into the SES, and what a catch. So that would have been pretty stoked. I don't doubt that you would have had plenty of competition for the role. Congratulations on getting the role. But tell us, how was that when you moved from the defence in emergency services? What were some of the challenges? Because I don't doubt there would have been quite a difference in the way they operate.
Very different. I had to learn to speak normal person,
right,
and understand that the...
Were there many acronyms?
Oh, I mean, I brought so many with me, and then, you know, more were introduced. But it really, for me, was about understanding that, particularly in the state emergency service, where you've got your permanent paid staff, but your operational staff are all volunteers, right? They do it for nothing.
Yeah.
They do it for love. What I learned was there are many reasons why people volunteer. And just as I tapped into clinicians in my health career, I tapped into the volunteers to better understand what motivated them to become a volunteer and what we could do to support each other. So I used to call it the win-win. I win because you give me your time free of charge and you get up at all hours of the day and night and go out and help people. Okay, so what motivates you to do that? And then how can I thank you and show you respect for that service? And so over the first 6 months, I sort of eased my way in, almost became the student again, and to learn and understand the environment in which I was operating in, because it was very foreign, because it would have been really easy for me in my enthusiasm and nervousness to default to being an Army officer, not the chief of a volunteer service. And on occasion, Brigadier Whelan did pop up.
Right.
And what I was very grateful for was the fact that I, you know, gave license to my staff to remind me when I was being Brigadier Whelan. In fact, I try to give license to my staff now when I default, because what I do know is I default to being Brigadier Whelan, not Chief Officer or now Commissioner Whelan, when I am questioning myself, when I have some self-doubt. That is my safe space. What I need to realise is that might be my safe space, but it's not necessarily a great leadership trait in the emergency services, because the culture is very different. I mean, they're all hierarchical structures. Everybody wears a uniform. Yeah. We all love identity. We all have our tribe. But the level of the way you interact and the level of discipline is very, very different.
It's, yeah, I just think when you said that before, I don't, surely there's positives to Brigadier Whelan coming in. Like, there'd be some things that would bring that would be very beneficial.
Oh, there are. I think the fact that particularly in the last 5 years of my career was very much focused on running an enterprise, creating opportunity, writing massive business cases for government, and my level of interaction at that sort of senior executive level has allowed me to bring a level of business acumen to the ACT Emergency Services Agency, which is still a very young organisation. I also am a bit of a risk taker. So obviously my risk is calculated. But as a risk taker, being bold enough to ask government for some funding for initiatives that previously somebody with a traditional emergency service background might be hesitant to ask for. So in a way, the best and sometimes the worst comes out in me. I mean, you know, one of the things that I have brought with me, both through my own lived experience and as what I see myself as a healthcare professional in contributing to healthcare, is that the health needs and particularly the mental health arena for first responders, it does not discriminate what uniform you wear or what service you're from, whether it's military or emergency services. And what I have brought with is a very, very strong desire to do the right thing and contribute to establishing, you know, a health system of sorts within our own emergency services arena.
And was that part of the role that you were brought in to do initially, or was that something when in 2019 you were made commissioner?
So what we were asked for in the application process for the commissioner's role was a normal resume, and you fill out your characteristics of a senior executive. I actually submitted a 5-year plan of what I would seek to do as the commissioner. So I wrote a vision and statement and threw my hat in the ring. You know, there was a little bit of concern around me not having a fire background, particularly as bushfire threat is at the time remains the most significant threat to the ACT. So I'd acquitted myself quite well as the chief of SES, but there was a fear that I may not have enough of that background. And at my interview, I can remember them asking me about that, and I had said to the panel, well, there's a panel member here, and I didn't realise he was actually going to be a panel member in my job interview. I said, but I had actually reached out to Shane Fitzsimmons when I was acting in the role for support and guidance and mentoring. So I, exactly what I had done as a non-doctor, I did the same thing. And Shane spoke about that to the panel, and clearly that allayed their fear about me not having a strong fire background. But certainly my ideas were attractive to them. And, you know, in the 3 years I've been in the role, we've had some really challenging times, the 1920 Black Summers, fires, major storms. But I've also secured, you know, several large funding packages from both our own government and the ACT and some Commonwealth funding to really drive change in both urban fire service and in the ambulance service, and about to tap dance on my dinner in front of the treasurer in the next month for really strong funding line for our volunteer services as well.
That's fantastic. So when you took over the role of Commissioner ACT Emergency Services in 2019, did you have any doubts? Were you confident getting in the role? Was it something that you were just ready to sink your teeth into and get amongst it? And were some of the challenges that you would have received operationally with the fires, and let's talk about a bit of that and how you had to overcome that without your background. I think that would have also been a positive in that service. I think having someone without that background could have been a positive.
Look, it was, in that I asked a lot of questions. And I didn't ask questions because I doubted people. I asked a lot of questions because I wanted to better understand And in doing so, created an environment where we were starting to look at some of the problems from a different perspective and fight the fire from a very different perspective. Was I nervous going into the job? Absolutely. And I think that was a good thing, because if I was too relaxed going into the job, and I would not like any of our members or our community to ever think that I just presume away and assume away role. So I think a little bit of nervousness and excitement does propel you to try and do the best you can. I wasn't expecting, you know, Black Summer to hit us within a couple of months of being appointed, but it happened. It was, in my mind, a baptism of fire, pardon the pun, for me. But it wasn't dissimilar to my time in Arche. I'd only been commanding the hospital for a very short period of time before I was deployed on that operation. And so I think that's where, you know, Georgina Will and the Army officer really did benefit me personally, but also the agency. It's, I very easily switch into operational mode and can focus and deliver at a fairly high operational tempo for quite an extended period of time. I think it's just my own battle rhythm allows me to do that. But, you know, we had some challenges, as every state and territory did during that dreadful period. Our people were exposed to some, you know, terrifying events, both when they deployed interstate and back in the ACT when we had our own major fire. And of course, my son became very ill during that period of time as well. So I was trying to juggle being a commissioner and also being a wife and a mother. And yeah, it was a pretty challenging time, but I would not do it, because I think I always try to look at every experience, whether, you know, you've enjoyed it or it's been challenging, as, you know, just another building block for me as a human being, as an individual, and try and learn from it. So,
is something obviously you're incredibly, incredibly proud of, the SES and the volunteers that you represent through the organisation. I mean, the more that you spend time with them, that you see what they can achieve, is it something that just, you know, inspires you?
I say this all the time, and I did a lot of community engagement during the bushfire storm season of 1920, very much out there with our community, keeping them informed on what was happening. Because one of the big lessons we'd learned from the 2003 bushfires was that the emergency services had disconnected itself from the community, and there wasn't great communication, and the community felt isolated and almost abandoned, even though that wasn't deliberate, that's how it played out. And I, you know, regularly would say to our community how privileged I am to work with these people, and how fortunate they should feel, because these people are out there every day keeping them safe. They are truly an inspiring group of individuals. And for some of them, it is amazing to see. And, you know, our volunteers range in age from, you know, 17, 18, so we run a cadet program, right through to, we've got volunteers in their 80s. And in the middle of that are volunteers who are still working full-time, young families, studying, and they really do juggle their lives to be able to volunteer. And it's, I think it takes a very special person to do what they do.
100%. I agree with that. With the health and wellness programs that are being implemented throughout the SES, tell us about your involvement with that, or your advisory capacity, or how that's happened, and a little bit about the program and how that's going.
Yeah, so there's a couple of programs that we're running. So one of the areas that emerged while I was the chief of SES was nationally the State Emergency Service were looking at what they call fit for task, and that was to ensure that our people are as well as they possibly can be, and that their physical employment standards are established to match the role they'll undertake, and in doing so, reduce the likelihood of injury and impact on their wellness. That program, slow to start, took us a while to get the research and then to partner with university, but very proud that late last year we got all the ethics approval and the training and the mentoring underway, and this year we'll formally launch the Fit for Task program for the State Emergency Service. I'm hoping, I was actually down at Bond University last week, I'm hoping it will be the catalyst for a similar program right across the emergency services. Now, people get scared when we talk about physical employment standards and fit for task and what that means. They see it as a barrier to service. I see it as an enhancement and an obligation as an employer that we should be promoting these kind of programs. Run a similar program, but it's not compulsory, Fire and Rescue ACT, where it's the physical testing barriers are quite significant. The level of physical fitness required and strength required, quite often an applicant will come back 2 or 3 years in a row before they'll get through the program. Some will never get through it. What we've been introducing is a mentoring and training program for civilian applicants, and particularly for female applicants, to help build up their level of fitness and confidence prior to them applying formally and then working their way through the program. And we see that as a benefit for civilians before they even become our employees, because we're working with them to reduce their injury rates, build their confidence. But there's a lot more to be done in that space. There are elements of our industry, our community, that fear something like that being introduced would reduce the number of people available to volunteer,
right,
and might be a barrier for it. So I tend to be a half glass full rather than a half glass empty. But I think it's important that we start to look at those things.
Well, I mean, they're only going to benefit more from doing it.
Oh, look, absolutely. And we've got a small but emerging team in ESA that is a very small group with initially not a lot of money, now rolling out some fabulous. Our peer support program is one of the best in the country, and it tailors to all four services, not just one.
Right.
We have a multidiscipline chaplaincy group that have been running yoga, meditation. We put our employees through the ADF Arts program, particularly those who have a diagnosis of ESD, and we put them through that program 4 weeks, fully paid, with the support of the Defence Force and our own government that allows me to do that. And we're starting to see the benefits come through. So we've been trying some really out-of-the-box type ideas, which I think in the long term will pay off tenfold for us.
I mean, some of the challenges in the role and trying to implement something like that as well.
Oh, look, I've got to say, and that the hardest thing is the industrial bodies working with the unions. And look, I'm not a union basher by a long shot. But, you know, the emergency services industry is heavily influenced by its industrial representation, and it should be. It's there to protect the worker. But sometimes the level of engagement consultation is so protracted.
Right.
It takes a long time.
Slow.
It is very slow to get things done. I think, again, one of the other problems is, and it's not dissimilar to my observations in defence, you know, people are frightened of losing their jobs if they declare they have an illness or an injury, particularly mental health, and they feel quite stigmatised by it. And, of course, there really is no transition plan. And that's an area that I think we all need to work much harder on is, you know, for those individuals who will get to a point of recovery where they can come back to a workplace but not their primary employment role, how can we do that better? How can we support individuals to transition? I mean, the most heartbreaking thing I've ever seen, both in my military career and now in my emergency services career, is young people who feel they are permanently incapacitated when in fact they are incapacitated to a certain extent, but with good case management and good multidiscipline team supporting them and a transition program would have so many more opportunities opened up for them. It just would be a different role, not the one they were originally in.
Do you think the culture is changing a little bit around that stigma within the services?
I believe it is, and I think it's a generational thing. I think we have to accept that what we have to do in the leadership team is put our money where our mouth is and follow through on these programs and demonstrate to the individuals with tangible outcomes that there is a pathway, there is an alternative way to manage these unfortunate events that don't lead to career ending. It's just job variation. But I think we have to be delivering on our commitment, and that tangible demonstration through the generations that are now coming through will adjust, will it'll actually change their attitudes. Because at the moment they only know what they know, and what they know is what the, you know, the long timers, as I call them, tell them, and stories that they will share, which encourage people to hold back on declaring illness or injury. By demonstrating some success stories and changing the narrative around the lunch table, that in and of itself is part of the cultural change. But it all comes down to two things: money and leadership.
Yeah. Well, you certainly seem to be making some inroads in the money side of things with the funding.
Yeah.
Which is exciting, tapping into resources that probably previously haven't been explored. So that's a massive help to the services, no doubt. Where do you think the biggest need for resources, funds, is in the emergency services sector?
So it's in the boring, what people say, what's the boring, you know, the long term. So we need to be doing prevalence studies. We need to actually understand what we don't know. We've got a baseline where we're at. You know, we need to be doing gap analysis and working through, okay, how do we tailor the services that we are providing within our organisation to meet the unique needs of the organisation in which we live? But they need to be evidence-based, and we need to be able to sustain them. I think the hardest part for any leader, for any organisation, for even a member within an organisation who is unwell, is how do you navigate this system? You know, it's fraught with danger. Yeah. There are traps out there for new players, and I think, you know, I hate using these terms, but we do. We need to simplify it. It needs to be a coordinated approach. In my presentation this afternoon, I've got a slide and it's shelves. And there's a whole variety of different coloured pebbles in jars on the shelves. And I feel like you should be able to go in and there's a menu, there's a shopping list. And what meets my needs for my organisation may differ slightly from what your needs are. But what we know is every product on the shelf has been quality assured.
Yes.
It's safe. It's been tested. It's been validated. And, you know, you can draw from those options, because I think organisationally our needs change as well over time. And it's, I mean, listening to the presentations the last 2 days have been fantastic, but it's, you know, it's a challenging environment for us to work in.
Georgina, as you look to the future, what excites you most about your role, about where things are heading and contribution?
What excites me the most at the moment is the more open we are in having these conversations. You know, you can flick through LinkedIn, podcasts, you know, social media, and what we have is individuals who are so brave to be able to share their stories and get the conversation started, and now continuing the conversation about, okay, sharing your lived experience is informing us of the challenges that our people are facing. Now, what are we going to do about it? And what excites me is that I think within the emergency services, I feel like I'm going back in time, but for a good reason. I think we are at a turning point where we'll go from talking about it and some pilot programs and some initiatives to, you know, really coming together in a collaborative way to make available programs. What's been great about, particularly here, is, you know, our peer support program, we didn't make that up. Our friends in Queensland Ambulance Service shared their learnings with us.
Yeah.
We've been talking to Victoria over the last 2 days about a couple of programs they're running. So we're in an almost pay it forward system now of coming together and sharing, and that people don't have to be original. There's so much good stuff out there we can tap into and share. You know, the hardest part will be funding it. And that is still a challenge for all of us. You know, our healthcare systems will continue to come under pressure nationally, and we have to recognise that we're part of that. And when we start to prioritise how we spend money, all the machinery in the world and the sexy training is great. But if we don't understand and potentially risk manage our budgets and start to funnel deliberately money into the wellness space, then what we'll have is lots of exciting vehicles and training programs, and we won't have a lot of people to put on them.
Well, hopefully we can sort that out, but it looks like it's going to be challenging coming up. But I'm sure, like you said, if we keep the the walls down and share everything we can amongst the different services, different sectors and the different jurisdictions and the different agencies. Yeah. We don't have to rebuild it from scratch, and we just try and use what works and provide as many services that work so that we can best address the challenges for the people.
There's a space in that sandpit for everyone.
I like the way you put that. Georgina, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
So they can contact me via my ESA Facebook site, which is the ESA ACT ESA Commissioner, or they can contact me on LinkedIn, Georgina.Wheeler on LinkedIn.
Perfect. And before you go, what is your favourite NRL team?
The Raiders.
Raiders. Well, they're overdue.
I know. It was a bad start last week. Actually, it wasn't. It was there's potential there.
Oh my God. Well, I hope it's the year of the Raiders for your sake. Good luck. And thanks so much for your time. Appreciate your effort.
Thanks, Sam. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.